Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Cardiff City podcast brought to you by Wales Online. I'm your host Glenn Williams, and over the next hour and 15 minutes, you'll be hearing from a true Bluebirds legend. I went up to Newcastle to see former Cardiff City, Newcastle and Sunderland striker Michael Chopra to talk about his upbringing, his time at Newcastle, why he loved the Welsh capital so much, and the controversies off the pitch that punctuated his career. This is Michael Chopra in his own words. So Michael, thank you for joining us for a really special edition of this podcast. Just want to start and take you back to your childhood. Born Rocky Michael Chopra. Can you explain that one to me?
Do you know what? I can't. To this day, I've not really asked my mum and dad what it was about. As far as I'm aware, with me being half Indian, Rocky's like an English Indian name. But my mum wanted me to have an English name, so I think that's why. Where the Michaels come from, and then growing up, really, it's from a young age people have just taken to me as Michael. It wasn't until I went to India in 2016, I think, that I decided that I want to be known as Rocky. When I was playing football, I decided to go completely the other way and change it just for a year. So yeah, that's how I think it's come about.
So your upbringing in Newcastle then, you had, did you say, an Indian dad and an English mum. Can you talk me through a little bit of your upbringing, what you were like?
Do you know what, I was lucky because my dad used to play football, followed Newcastle United, season tickets and that sort of thing. So I was lucky going to a lot of Newcastle United games when they were in the old First Division. So already at a young age I had a footballing background, whereas I'll use my cousins as examples. Both same as me, brought up Indian, but their parents were like, you've got to go down the academical route, you've got to go to work hard at school and that sort of thing, whereas my mum and dad were totally the opposite. They wanted me to be good at sports and that sort of thing, and so in a way I'm thankful that my mum and dad pushed me that way, because when you're born with a talent, and they've probably seen that from an early age, and thankfully I made them proud one day.
What do your parents do for a living when you were growing up?
When I was growing up, my dad had a news agent, so I would go there after my Sunday league football and take all the stickers for my sticker book and things like that. Take a load of sweets and take them to school and that sort of thing. My mum just used to help out with my dad. It wasn't until later on in my career that my dad decided it was too much, going to work at 5-6 in the morning, coming home at 8 o'clock at night. He wanted to spend more time with me and wanted to see and be at a lot of my games, really. So we decided to pack that in and go down another route.
What sort of a kid were you, Michael? Were you easy to get on with? Were you a bit of a tearaway?
I was a bit of a tearaway. I must admit, I was in Newcastle. You use the word toe rag. For my mum and dad, I was a nightmare. But that, in a way, that's probably made me the person I was. Because in a way you need that in football. You have to have somewhere about you to reach the top, and I did that. At times I was in trouble for the wrong reasons that I shouldn't have been, but that's the person I was, and you can't really change it.
What, was there always football then? You talk about your parents and the sort of upbringing that you had. Was it just football, nothing else? You didn't want to go down an academic route, nothing like that?
No, it was just football, really. From a young age, when started playing Sunday league football at the age of 7, 8. I was playing a year above myself. Then I got to an age where I was playing for Newcastle as well at the age of 9. And I had a choice to make. I think it was when I was 12, 13 years old. The FA put this program in place where young kids are only allowed to play, I think it was about 60 games in a season. So you had your county, your school, Newcastle United, and there would have been another team, and in that season I was only allowed to play 60 games. We had a book, we had to get it signed by the manager and everything, every game I played, and at the end of the season you had to hand it in to the FA. So some games I wasn't allowed to play them because they would try and keep me for other games to make sure that I was playing in them. And it wasn't just me, it was every kid in England, I think it was. Then it got to the age of 13, I think it was. Newcastle United, they put a rule in place, or it might have been the FA, where you could either play for the academy, School of Excellence at the time, or you choose your school and your Sunday League football. So me playing for Newcastle, being a Newcastle fan, I was adamant that no one's going to take this opportunity away. I want to be a footballer, I want to play for Newcastle United. So I pulled away from the school, pulled away from Sunday League football, county football, and played for Newcastle United, whereas a lot of my friends left Newcastle to go the other route, and they didn't make it as a professional footballer. So I think to myself, I wonder how they would have went if they had took the route that I went down.
Talk me through getting into that Newcastle youth system, and obviously, like you just said, you're a massive Newcastle fan. Talk me through what happened. Did you get a call up? Did scouts come and watch you play Sunday League?
Yeah, it was John Carver, in fact, who used to be, he was the Newcastle manager at one point, assistant manager to Bobby Robson. He was a School of Excellence like director at the time, head of scouting. He had spoke to my mum and dad and asked me would I like to go and play for Newcastle United, and I think that was a dream come true for my dad, because he wanted to make it, wasn't good enough, had a bad knee injury, so it stopped him playing. But to see his son getting asked to play for the School of Excellence, it was a proud moment for him. And then you take it in your stride, it's a big thing. You're going to school and you're playing for Newcastle United, you know what I mean? You're telling your mates, oh, we're playing. At the time, it was Leeds, it was all the local teams around the area. So I think at the time, Scarborough were in the second, third division. So you're going Scarborough, Hartlepool, Leeds, Bradford, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, all them teams, you were playing them on a regular basis. But it was great because it was something different, that I'm not playing local teams and local players. My knowledge of the game's getting a lot better because you're playing against other teams from other regions.
You always a striker? Do you always
no,
have that?
No, I wasn't. When I first started playing, I was a right winger. I think I was skinny but quick. So they decided to be, he's not good enough to hold the ball up and that sort of thing. So to stick him on the wing, get him to the byline and whip it in for somebody else. But it wasn't until probably 10, 11 when I decided to really change position. I'm not happy assisting other people. I want to be on the one on the end of it, scoring the goals and getting all the acknowledgement from the managers and getting the man of the match awards and that sort of thing.
And you impressed so much at Newcastle, and you earned international honours, didn't you, at youth level?
Yeah, it was. I'll go back to early Newcastle days. I was on the verge of leaving Newcastle around about 13-14. A guy who used to be head of Middlesbrough Football Club, Peter Kirkley, he had kind of got wind that Newcastle were going to release me. So he had asked my mum and dad, would I want to go to Middlesbrough and that sort of thing, if they did release me. But Newcastle decided to keep me on, and thankfully it all worked out for me. But yeah, going back to playing for England, schoolboy level, I was going for England trials at Lillishall at the time. I was going to stay there for a year, but they decided to close it down. We went for the trials and everything. I was good enough in the trials. Come to under 15s, you do all these medical tests before you play in the schoolboy cup. So you're playing Scotland, England, Wales. And when I went on international duty, I think it was Northern Ireland I was going to play, one of the results come back from my medical that I had a heart condition, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, and it's 1 in 300 people have it, where you have an extra valve in your heart, so the blood goes through another valve and that sort of thing. So until I had more tests, I wasn't allowed to play for England schoolboys. And I was absolutely devastated. I was like, I'm going to be playing for England on a Friday night live on Sky, and I've been told that because of this condition, until I get more tests done, I can't play for England. And I just broke down in tears. I was absolutely devastated. So Newcastle United and the FA were brilliant with me. They got tests on me, ECGs and cardiology tests and all that thing. And eventually, the top people at the FA looked at the results and said everything was fine. Happy to go ahead, and then I can make my debut for England schoolboys.
When you said you were playing against the home nations there, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, England, who were your contemporaries? Do you remember any players that went on to make it at your...
Yeah.
Against them?
The players that we had in our team were... We had Jermaine Pennant, who was in Notts County, just signed for Arsenal for $2 million. Dean Ashton was part of the team. Glenn Johnson was part of the team as well. We had great players at the time, do you know what I mean? A lot of them have made it in the big leagues.
Any Welsh players you remember from that time?
Going back 20 years, yeah. do you know what? I've got the programmes in the house. If I pull the programmes out, I'll be able to look straight away. I know when I played against France at a young age, as one of the French players was playing there. I played against them when I was playing in club football. He messaged me on Twitter and that sort of thing. And that was like 10 years after playing against each other at a young age. But yeah, but I'm sure there would have been a couple of players that have played for Scotland. Obviously, Darren Fletcher was one of them. He used to play for Scotland. Mark Fotheringham was a brilliant player, a Scottish player. He was another player, but I'd have to look at the programmes for Wales and Ireland.
So you progress through the Newcastle Academy system, you've represented England at youth level, then you go into the top level of Newcastle Academy. There was obviously a natural barrier for you to get into that first team. How hard was it for you just to break into that first team at Newcastle?
It was hard. I remember when I was 15 years old, I signed like a pre-contract to say that I was going to sign professional terms at Newcastle, everything going well, as long as I didn't get injured sort of thing. So I kind of put my schoolwork to one side. I knew I was going to become a footballer if things were progressing the way I'd agreed a contract and that sort of thing. So schoolwork, GCSEs, it didn't interest me. It was like, just write your name, there you go, see you later. I'm going to become a professional footballer. That's what I had in my back of my mind. I was so focused on being a professional. So yeah, trying to break into the first team. I remember Newcastle United had, as a strikers, you had Amiobi, who just broke through. You had Shearer, you had Bellamy, you had Kieran Dyer, who was a great young player. Carl Court was there, Lamana Lualua. These were all players that were playing international football. And then here's myself, a young 16, 17, 18 year old, coming through the ranks, just desperate to make it in the first team. But I was always training with the first team and training with the reserves at a young age. I would travel with the reserves when I was 15, 16, getting experience. I would leave school on a Friday. Every Friday I'd get permission to leave school and to go and play for the youth team, under 17s, under 18s. And as a 15-year-old, that was a big thing. And then people, as I was getting into breaking through to the first team, people were saying he's the next Alan Shearer and he's this and that. But I was just determined to make my debut and to pull on the famous black and white shirt.
So you say there people were saying you're the next Alan Shearer. To a young Geordie kid, that's a massive villain. You can either take that one of two ways. Either that can serve as motivation or it can be daunting and make you go the other way.
Yeah, I think it depends on how strong the person is, because some people get all this acknowledgement and adulation and they don't make it, they go the other way. But I wanted to fulfill all these famous players like Newcastle United had that have walked down the tunnel and stepped onto St James's Park and that sort of thing. It was a dream for me, and I wasn't going to let anybody come in the way and stop my dream. I was so focused on doing what I wanted to do and doing what basically all my life for 10 years that I kicking the ball around in the streets and waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning, going to school and just to play football with my mates in the play yard. I wanted to make sure that I've come so far that nobody's going to take it away from me. It's down to myself, and once you get the opportunity, you've got to take it.
Just talk me through your Newcastle debut then. What was the situation surrounding that? You know, how proud were you for you and your parents and things like that?
Well, I think it had been coming. I was getting told by Bobby Robson and John Corvo would tip me off saying, you're going to be in the squad, you're going to be on the bench soon, and that sort of thing. Just keep doing what you're doing in the reserves. And then obviously, I think it was the Worthington Cup back in the day. Once the cup competitions come along, a lot of teams give the young players a chance. And I was on the bench, Everton at home it was. And I came on just before the end of, about 60, 70 minutes I think it was. And the game went into extra time, it was 3-3 I think it was at the time. We had a man sent off, so on my debut down to 10 men, 3-3, extra time, it's gone to penalties. And I'm thinking to myself, oh,
time to make yourself a hero.
Bobby Robson, who wants to take a pen? Yeah, I'm desperate. Gaffer, give me a pen. Penalty comes along, Richard Wright standing in front of me. In training all week, scoring goals from penalty spot, practicing. Throughout my career, always scoring penalties. Step up in front of the Sir John Hall stand. And I've had a shot, but for some reason I've changed my mind and I've decided to be fancy Dan and try and go in the top corner. Whenever I've took pens, I've always gone in the bottom corners. I've tried to go in the top corner, I've hit it over the bar. And I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I remember standing in the showers after the game with tears in my eyes. We had lost the penalty shootout. I had tears in my eyes, and on my debut I've missed a pen for my hometown club. It wasn't just me that missed, I think Hugo Viana and Lauren Robert missed as well. So I wasn't the only one.
In good company.
Yeah. So, but this is one thing that will always stick in my mind, and as an 18-year-old making my debut for Newcastle United, Alan Shearer walked into the showers and just said to me, he says, listen, Chops, he says, don't worry about it. He says, try missing the penalty against Sunderland. A couple of weeks ago, I think he just missed the penalty against Sunderland to go on to win the game. And he said to me, he says, don't worry. He says, imagine how I feel. I missed the penalty against Sunderland. He says, the one thing you've got about you is you had the bottle to go up there and take it. He says, an 18-year-old, he says, a lot of them players on X amount of money come from millions of pounds. He says, they don't have the bottle like yourself to go and do it. He says, don't let it affect you. And from that day, that always stick in my head, how much appreciation I had for Alan at the time, England international, scoring goals in the World Cups. And to come up to me and say that was a big thing, and it meant
a lot
to me.
Yeah. Massive.
Yeah.
So obviously we'll come on to your loan clubs and stuff in a bit, but was this 6 years and 21 appearances for Newcastle? As a Geordie fan, playing for Newcastle anyway must be a huge achievement, but do you feel a little bit disappointed you didn't go on and play more?
Yeah, I do feel a bit disappointed, yeah. I think that before I made my debut, I think I was ready for the first team before that. I personally believe I was getting held back. I don't know why. But that's just my thinking. I was ready, I was scoring goals at youth team, reserve team, at a young age, 15, 16. And I believe that I should have made my debut before what I did, but for some reason I didn't. But you look back on them things and it's all ifs and buts, isn't it? It's, if the penalty goes in, something else could have happened. It's a thought sort of thing. So in a way, you look back and you can't really complain and that sort of thing, you know.
I'm sure if you were a kid and somebody said to you, you're going to play 21 times for Newcastle United, I'm sure you'd be.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be happy, you know what I mean, pulling on the black and white shirt 21 times and scoring Premier League goal against your local rivals and that sort of thing. But some managers I didn't get on with, some managers didn't like me, and you put it down to that as well.
So then you went on for loan spells at Watford, Notts Forest, Barnsley, but then obviously the Cardiff gig came up 2006. Can you talk me through that, how that came about?
Yeah, so my contract was running out in Newcastle, and the 2006 from January, I think it was, I'd started to play games and I was playing starting games. And I was doing well. I was creating chances for the players. I was scored a couple of goals in important games as well. So I had a meeting with the chairman at the time, Freddie Shepherd, and he offered me a contract. And it was a small increase to what it was, but I wasn't about money. I'm not a player that's all about money, do you know what I mean, at that time. So the money thing wasn't a problem when he was saying, oh, we're going to give you a little increase. More of a problem was I knew Alan Shearer was retiring, so I know that they had to go and spend a lot of money on a new striker to please the fans. So that puts me even further down the pecking order. So then I decided that actually I'm not going to sign a new contract. I'm going to try and go about things a different way. Maybe I'll have to take two steps back to take one forward, drop down a league and try and rebuild myself and get back into the Premier League that way. And at the time I had an agent, SFX it was, and Peter Ridsdale I knew from when I was at Barnsley because he was the chairman of Barnsley. We had a couple of players that were at Barnsley as well who were part of the agency, so they knew Ridsdale really well. Peter Ridsdale was the chairman at Cardiff, Sam Amar was the owner, and they contacted my agent and said, would Michael be interested in signing for Cardiff? And I went down to meet them, went to the stadium, Old Indian Park. It wasn't a massive stadium like I'm used to at Newcastle United, but it was a stadium that I knew if the fans were, your team was doing well, the fans are going to get right behind you and they're gonna support you and that sort of thing. So we had a chat and spoke to the manager at the time, Dave Jones, told me what his plans were, and I decided to go for it and go and sign for Cardiff City.
What was your relationship like with Dave Jones? I spoke to Steve McPhail a couple of weeks ago, and he always says how much of an influence Dave Jones was on getting him to Cardiff City. How did you get on with him as a manager?
From when I met Dave Jones, when I first went down to Cardiff, I knew that he was the right manager for me straight away. I could tell that if there was someone that needed to really give me a kick up the arse, give me a kick up the backside when things are going tough and I'm not playing well, then he's the right man for me. If things are going well, I know he'll respect me and give me be lenient with me, that sort of thing. Because Newcastle to Cardiff's a long way and you're leaving your family. And
I did it today, Michael, I know.
And I was leaving my family, my mum and dad, being brought up in Newcastle, travelling a long way down to Wales. And I was still quite young in terms of football at the time. I hadn't played many games. So you have to consider all that. And I went down there, and the staff, the players, when I got down there, everyone was fantastic with me. The fans were brilliant. And I couldn't have asked for anything else.
Did you strike up any immediate relationships and friendships with the players there?
Well, obviously I knew Steve McPhail from playing at Barnsley. Darren Pearce was there, he was the captain, he was great to get on with, took me under his wing. I remember we went to Vancouver for pre-season. Ricardo Shimica was there, Paul Parry, Joe Ledley was coming through the ranks, Neil Alexander was there. We had a good team. We had a lot of strong personalities, and whenever I needed help, I knew I could turn to them and ask them for help. And it was a great team at the time. You look back, and a lot of their players helped me.
So your first season there, 22 league goals in 44 games, included in the team of the year, must have been a sort of this is where I belong sort of moment for you, was it?
Yeah, it was. To step down from the Premier League when I've always dreamt of playing in the Premier League. Like I said, I had to take two steps back to take one forward. I couldn't ask for anything better. Being in the team of the year, scoring 22 goals, and I think I missed a few games as well from being suspended. Missed out on the Golden Boot by one goal, I think it was. But no, it was... it was a great achievement for me. stepping down and doing so well for Cardiff. Even though Cardiff finished mid-table, to score 22 goals on that team was a great achievement.
I know you said it's a long way from Newcastle to Cardiff, but often people draw comparisons with South Wales and the northeast of England in terms of its socio-economic standing, how close a community it is down there. Did you see comparisons between the two places?
Yeah, I did. When I spoke to the manager and things like that, and Sam Haman and Peter Ridsdale, they said to me, these fans, it'll be like the Newcastle fans, what you're used to. He says they'll get right behind the team, they're passionate. As long as you're working hard and doing well for the team, they'll be fully supportive and right behind you. And I could see that from the off. I had a great start to the season. And the fans were brilliant. They were right behind the team. We were flying at one point. I was thinking, God, what a team we've got.
You top the table in September.
We were beating teams like West Brom, Birmingham, who had just been relegated from the Premier League. We weren't just beating, we were dominating them, we were battering them. Ninian Park was bouncing at times. A lot of games were on the sky because we were doing so well. But we had a team of players that didn't quite make it in the Premier League, but they probably were too good for the Championship at the time. Like Peter Whittingham, Steve McPhail, Steve Thompson was brilliant for me as a strike partner. Kevin Campbell was there as well, who used to play for Everton and Arsenal. He was great for me. But we had such a good team spirit at that time. We thought we were going to go into games and who are these teams coming to Cardiff? Fans are right behind us. We're going to dominate them. We're going to batter teams.
Teams hate to come to
Yeah,
Indian
exactly.
Park, didn't they?
Especially in Indian Park because the fans were so close to the pitch. And I know people say, oh, it's a rubbish stadium, but that's what I needed at that time. I needed to be playing in a stadium like that. To
feel loved as well.
Yeah, well, that's what. To play well in football, you need to feel loved. You've got to feel wanted. And I felt that straight away with Cardiff City fans. And that's probably why I kept going back to them.
It sort of felt like at that time that Cardiff were really on the cusp of something. So why then did you leave at the end of the season?
Well, a little bit I was missing home.
Yeah.
Sunderland come knocking. Roy Keane rang me up.
When you were on pre-season?
When I was on pre-season, yeah, in Portugal. Dave Jones phoned me and he said to me, he says, I think Sunderland want to buy you. And I was like, oh my God, Sunderland. And I can't do it. Sunderland. Newcastle Sunderland's a massive thing. And
you scored against them?
Yeah, like the year later, I'd scored for Newcastle against Sunderland at the Stadium of Light. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm a huge Newcastle fan. And that sort of thing. I can't do it. Spoke to my family. And then Dave Jones said to me, he was like, you're not training. You're not playing in any games. We're not taking a risk. Even if you say no, you want to train. We're not doing it because I think Cardiff at the time were financial difficulty. We were training in a training ground that wasn't Cardiff's. We were eating our lunches at our porter cabins. We were doing weights in the car park. Cardiff had this ambition that they wanted to build a new stadium. They wanted to be in a new training ground. And I think, in a way, they were banking on me leaving the club so that they could fund all of this facilities. So Dave wouldn't let me train, he wouldn't let me play in any of the games just in case I got injured. And then I was...
How did you feel at that time, then? Were you a bit sort of juxtaposed, I guess?
Well, yeah, because I was just a footballer. I want to play as many games as I can pre-season. I want to get fit. In my mind, I wasn't really going to go to Sunderland, but Cardiff didn't want to take the risk because there would have probably been other clubs knocking on the door as well. When somebody scored 22 goals in the Championship, clubs in the Premier League normally take notice. And then I was at the training ground, I think, watching the lads train, and I had my phone, and a private number come up, and I was like, who's ringing me? So I've answered it. Hi, Michael, it's Roy Keane. I'm like, Roy Keane's on the phone, and I'm like nervous and everything because I used to watch this guy on the television playing for captain of Manchester United, winning the Champions League and that sort of thing, with Premier League titles. This guy's a big thing in football. He's ringing me. Why is he ringing me? But I had a good chat. He was brilliant with me. Understood the Newcastle background, the connection, and just said to me, look, it's your decision. If you don't want to come, he says, I got nothing against you. But if you come, I'll be fully behind you because of your roots. I'll support you as much as I can. And that sort of thing. He says, look, don't make a decision now. Sleep on it, speak to your family. You've got a couple. Oh, he says, I'll call you back in a couple of days. So even Roy Keane to ring me then, it was brilliant to have somebody like that. Means a lot because he's worked with great players, he's played with great players, and to class me as a good player that he wanted in his team, it meant something to me. So I come off the phone, rang my mum and dad, rang my missus at the time, spoke to Dave, and spoke to my agent. And my agent said to me, he says, listen, there will be other clubs interested. He says, I know Everton have been looking at you, Aston Villa at the time as well, but the opportunity of going back up to the North East, living in Newcastle again, being home with family and friends, I think it was too much of a good opportunity to turn down, and obviously to learn a lot from a manager like Roy Keane, who's worked with Sir Alex Ferguson. And I just decided to go ahead, so he called me back and I just said, I'm ready to move. I just said, I want to do it. I want to come and play for Sunderland. And he said he just said to me, fantastic. We'll get everything sorted, come up for the medical. And from then, it was brilliant. I never looked back.
So, Michael, you move back to Sunderland. How was that? What sort of reception did you immediately get?
Well, from the fans, wasn't very good. We've just signed a player for $5 million who's scored a goal against us the year before for our local rivals. We got relegated from the Premier League. Why are we signing an ex Newcastle United player to try and keep us in the Premier League? It didn't make sense to them. But I was a type of player that wanted to prove people wrong. And thankfully, I managed to prove a lot of people wrong, and I managed to get the fans on my side quicker than what I actually thought as well.
So obviously you had that first season, then you missed the start of the next season because you were in rehab, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you just talk me through that time a little bit?
Well, it was during the first season I had the problem.
And it's a gambling problem.
Yeah, and I went to Roy Keane, I said, Roy, I've got a problem. Mentally I'm not right, not focused on football. And he just said, listen, Chops, you've done so well for me, you've scored important goals for me, we're always happy to help. I think Roy Keane's had his own problems in the past, so he knew exactly what he was going through. And ever since that day when I talked to him about it, he was brilliant with me. He would invite me to his office, sit one-on-one, having a chat with him, how am I feeling today, and that sort of thing. And people talk about Roy Keane and say he's this and that, but I've got nothing but respect for the man. He was brilliant with me and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until the second season when I went down to the Sport and Chance Clinic. I was training down there because I knew I had to train to stay fit. And I came out of rehab midweek, I think it was. We were playing Middlesbrough on the Saturday. I think I came out on the Wednesday, trained with the Sunderland team on the Thursday, done really well, was flying, trained on the Friday, was flying again, and the gaffer, Roy at the time, said, I'm going to put him on the bench, he's looking sharp, he's this and that, he's been brilliant. And we played Millsborough on the Saturday, and I think early into the game, one of the strikers got injured. And Roy always had this knack with me where he could see in my eye that whenever he turned to me on the bench, you could see it in my eye that for some reason that I'd get him a goal or something. The season before it happened so many times, Aston Villa away, Fulham away, he'd look at me and he'd say, Chops, you're gonna score today, I can see it in you. God knows how he knew, but whenever he said it to me, I always scored. And he said it to me when I was coming off the bench to go to the sideline. He said to me, he says, look, you've been flying in training. He says, this is going to be your day today. You're going to get us the winner. And I scored as well. I think I scored in the early in the second half, I think it was. And I scored late in the second half. We went on to win the game 2-0, and I scored. So early in the week, I was in rehab. Towards the end of the week, I was scoring goals in the Premier League again. It was amazing how things can change so quick, but a lot of credit's down to Roy. And Roy left the club because he had whatever was going on with him and the chairman at the time, Niall Quinn. Ricky Sapreza took over, didn't really see eye to eye with him. So I knew my Sunderland career was coming to an end when Roy had left, really.
What was the sort of breaking point where you thought, right, I need to seek help here with this gambling problem?
Well, I had the problem when I was in Newcastle. I was flying to Malaysia pre-season and playing cards with big name players, and I was 17 at the time, and I'm playing cards with these big name players, and I was on probably 1,000 a week, 2,000 a week. These guys are 60,000, 70,000, 80,000, but I couldn't believe it at the time. Do you know what I mean? I was like,
wow.
Yeah, I'm sitting playing cards with Alan Shearer, Kieran Dyer, Craig Bellamy, Gary Speed, Shane Given, Solano, them type of people. I was growing up watching these people on TV, and I'm actually sitting on a plane playing cards with them. But as a player, as a young boy, it's like, doesn't matter, I'm going to be earning X amount, and I'm a big superstar, I'm going to be doing this, not a problem. But it just kept getting on top of me. And for some reason, I would never let it affect what was happening on the pitch.
No, that's right. Did you have a Cardiff as well?
Yeah, it was at Cardiff as well. Yeah, when I first came to Cardiff, I had the problem then. But I never told anyone about it. It was in my mind. I would go to the bookies. I think it was, look back now and I'm thinking to myself, the buzz I got from scoring goals, I was trying to find a buzz from somewhere else to try and accommodate it. And I wasn't a big drinker, never took drugs. So how could I replicate that buzz? And no other better place than gambling when you get a winner and that sort of thing. There's no better feeling. Getting a winner on a horse or a dog or winning a card game is the same as scoring a goal. It's the same buzz, do you know what I mean? So that's where I think, but people say, oh, it started to take effect on the pitch, but never once affected me on the pitch. I would play cards till 3-4 in the morning on an away trip with the lads, play the game the next day, and I'd be scoring 2-3 goals. It just never affected me.
So what was the watershed moment then that made you?
I knew I had to stop. I knew coming. As you get older, you know that you can't continue the way you were doing as a young player. Look, I was eating. The lads will tell you if you speak to the lads. My diet when I was playing for Cardiff and that sort of thing was horrendous, shocking. I'd be going to an away game and I'd be eating burgers and shit like that on a bus. Do you know what I mean? And the lads will tell you if you interview them. They'll tell you what was Chops' diet like. They'll say it was shocking. I'd turn up at training at Cardiff with like Krispy Kremes. I'd drive from Newcastle the night before, arrive to Cardiff 5 o'clock in the morning, have some Krispy Kremes from one of the drive-thrus on the way down, and then I'd go to training with these Krispy Kremes and stuff like that. I remember I went down one time, and Sean Connolly, the physio, walked in, right? And I was like, this lad's trying a donut and that. And this was on a Friday, yeah? We got a big game on the Saturday. It's like trying a donut, lad. He picked the box up and he just smashed them on the floor. I was like, Sean, what are you doing, man? 12 donuts, do you know what I mean? The Krispy Kremes. And he was like, who do you think you are and all that stuff? And but that was me, do you know what I mean? I could get away with it because I was my ability was natural. It was like, I didn't need to work on it. I wasn't a man that was going in the gym, working hard in the gym. It was just like, at the time I just thought, And I remember at the time, Alex Armstrong, I had a big conversation with him, fitness coach at Cardiff. And he said to me, he says, Chops, he says, you can't keep going on like this. He says, you can't just switch it on and off. Don't just have a switch on your body, like, switch it on and off.
It's
going to
catch up with you.
Yeah, so I can't remember who we were playing the next day, right? But on the Friday, we had the conversation. And the next day, before we were going out for the kickoff, I said to Alex, I went, Alex, I've got a switch on my leg, switch it on. So we tapped my leg, right? I scored like a couple of goals in the game, and I ran over after the game. I was like, Alex, you need to switch me off, mate. But even one of the match balls I've got, one of the match balls I've got, I think it was, might have been Plymouth away. I think it was Plymouth away. I've got the match ball at the house. I was looking at it like 2 months ago when I was going through the loft, and somebody's wrote on the match ball, pint of Coke anytime you like. Because I had a pint of Coke at half time, and I scored a hat trick in the second half. So do you know what, these little things, they all there. But then with the gambling and all that, I knew that I had to do something about it. I couldn't keep gambling thousands and then getting people coming to the training ground and that sort of thing. I knew I had to change the way I was going about things, and eventually things would catch up with you if you didn't do something about it.
So Ricky Sprazier takes over at Sunderland, and you're not getting as much game time as what you like, and then you go on the flown to Cardiff, is that right?
Yeah, I remember Dave was ringing me, Chops, we need you, we want you in. And I was saying, look, I can't do anything. This was when Roy Keane was the manager. And he was saying, Roy's got me on the bench. He says, I'm going to play the weekend and that sort of thing. I says, I'll keep in touch with you. And then we'll see what happens. And then Ricky took over. And I think it was like, I think deadline day was on a Monday. I think it was a Monday at the time. And it was like, I said to Dave, I went, Dave, I've just finished training. We're going to wait at the training ground. Let's try and push this deal through. I want to come on loan. I told Sunderland that I want to come on loan, but it's down to yous. Because I think Sunderland wanted, like, they wanted me to go on loan, but they wanted Cardiff to buy me in the summer as well. And I don't know if Cardiff wanted to do that. So I was waiting at the training ground from like half one. The deadline was closing at 5 o'clock. So we got to like 4:45 and I'm ringing Dave, what's happening? Just be patient. I'm like, there's 15 minutes left in the window, you told me to be patient. It's like, nah, we're getting things done, we're just working on a transfer fee. So it was like a minute left of the window. And like, he's rang me and it's like, right, get yourself inside quick, get yourself inside, sign the document. So like 20, 30 seconds to go before the window closed. I was running into Sunderland training ground trying to sign the paperwork to get the deal pushed through before the window closed. And since then, I went to Cardiff.
So in the February of that year, you had a very sort of public breaking up with your then wife.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you went to Sunderland because you wanted to go back up to the North East, was coming back down to Cardiff, maybe a way to escape what was going on up in the North East?
It wasn't really to escape, it was... I knew playing Cardiff, back to Cardiff, I was playing my best football. Even if I had problems with my wife, she would have came with me to Cardiff if need be. So it wasn't a case of escaping from the problems with my ex-wife and that sort of thing. It was just a case of finding a club where I was going to be happy. A manager that knew what I needed. And a club that had ambition as well. And Cardiff has always been the right fit for me. Been on loan 2-3 times and ever since the first time I went there in 2006, I knew it was the right club.
It was reported at the time that the November loan to Cardiff might have had a contributory factor to your marriage breaking down. Was there anything in that?
No, not at all. Obviously, people say these stories and that sort of thing. Well, in fact, you, at the end of the day, I had to do what was best for my football career. Even if I was with my wife at the time, going to Cardiff, she would have came down with me, that sort of thing. But it wasn't necessarily because we were on the verge of getting divorced. So there was no need for her to come down. Then it was a case of me to prove all these negative people wrong, saying, oh, he's finished, he's we already taken him back because of what he's done previously at the club and that sort of thing. But to me, it was just a case of I'm going back to a club where fans love me, manager knows what I need, and manager knew how to get the best out of me, and he'd done that as well.
How did you compartmentalise it all? Because you went from being in rehab for gambling, then your marriage breaks down, but you're still producing it on the pitch. You have to be quite strong to sort of differentiate what's going off the
Like I said to you, whenever I stepped on that over that white line, nothing would come into my mind. It was just football, Cardiff City, getting promoted, Sunderland staying in the Premier League. And people say, how would you do it? And I don't know. Obviously, it must be mental strength, and I'm strong enough to cope with whatever's going on in the background. But whenever I stepped off that white line and I'm sitting in my apartment overlooking Cardiff Bay, you get lonely, do you know what I mean? I moved from... I had a 5 or 6 bedroom mansion up near Corntown in near Bridge End, and I was there by myself, and I was living there by myself. Dave said to me, he says, why are you living in this big place and all that? And I was thinking, well, I've come from Sunderland, got to prove to the lads that I'm like a big dog sort of thing, do you know what I mean? So I've got to go and rent this like 4 or 5 grand a month big house, and I was sitting there playing computer with the lads, playing Call of Duty and that sort of thing. But like, four of the rooms weren't even getting used, so my bedroom wasn't even getting used because I was playing computer that much. I used to just like bring a blanket down and just chuck it on myself and just fall asleep with a computer on and the TV.
Who were the lads that were coming over to play Call of Duty with?
We had Jay Boothroyd, Danny Treequarter when he was on loan, Peter Whittenham, Gavin Ray, Kev McNaughton, Hudson. There was like 7 of us.
Who's the best?
Kev McNaughton was a joke. he was ridiculous in Call of Duty. He was scary, mate. Scary. But yeah, we would like finish training. We were like, right lads, 6 o'clock. We'll set a time for 6 o'clock. Everyone get on Call of Duty and that sort of thing. We'll all play in a team lobby, team deathmatch, and that sort of thing. 6 people, I think, could play in a team deathmatch against 6 random people. So we had like a clan name and everything, and we'd be
what
on.
What was your clan name?
I can't remember now. But we'd like have these headsets on, we'd be speaking, we'd be like training 9 till 1 with the lads, having banter with them. They'd go home, sort the kids out, put them to bed, we'd be sitting on the headsets till like 2, 3 in the morning playing Call of Duty. We'd come and train the next day and we're talking about Call of Duty, do you know what I mean? It was just like, it was a thing that we had at the time with the lads. So you're talking like half the starting 11. That playing on Saturday, we all like headsets, so the communication and the team bonding was brilliant. It was fantastic, and that's why I think Cardiff at the time we'd done so well, because all the lads would do stuff together. If one of the lads said, right lads, do you fancy going Nando's, or do you want to go for an Italian down on Cardiff Bay? If somebody said on the afternoon, 1 o'clock, do you want to go Nando's, or you'd get like 8, 9 people there. It wouldn't just be like 2 or 3. And I think that's the team spirit he had at the time. It was brilliant. But like I said, going back to like the, so I spoke to Dave Jones, and Dave said to me, he said, what are you living in this big house for? And I was like, oh, the internet's unbelievable, super quick fiber up, the broadband. He was like, what are you talking about? I said, nah, gaffer. I said, I'm playing Call of Duty and everything. I've got like 1 millisecond speed and all that to kill someone and stuff like that. He was like, Chops, what are you talking about? I was like, gaffer, it doesn't matter, you don't know about these computer games and stuff like that. He was like, Chops, I think you should get down to Cardiff Bay. Try and get a place down Cardiff Bay, and you'll be out and about. You can go to restaurants, you're not just like locked in. He would call it like a cage. He says, you're not locked in a cage and that sort of thing. Obviously, at the time, I had a driving ban as well. So Steve McPhill used to live like round the corner, so he used to pick me up and take me. He was like, Chops, you've got a driving ban. Your restaurants are on the bay and everything. He said, just come out of this big house, drop your ego and get yourself down on Cardiff Bay, go and live down there. So I found a place down on the bay and it was brilliant, overlooking the bay and everything. And obviously I had the problems going on.
Were they still going on that season?
yeah, they were going on only up until probably 3, 4 years ago.
Right.
But I was the type of player that I wasn't letting it affect anything, because if whatever was happening off the pitch was affecting me, then I knew that all the adulation and all the love I'm getting from the fans and the manager and players, if I stopped getting that, then I'd completely break down. I think I would have been suicidal. But I wasn't getting love off the pitch from people that you should be getting it off. It was like I was like getting the mixture of both, trying to accommodate it. So getting the love on the pitch was kind of accommodate getting the love off the pitch.
And that's why Cardiff fans are so good, because they're so fiercely loyal, aren't they?
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's when I always go back, and people talk about Newcastle fans are so loyal. But I always say Cardiff fans are brilliant. They're so loyal about the team. And even when I watch the games on the TV and you see empty seats, and I'm thinking, back in the day when we had this MacPhail, Boothroyd, Ledley, Whitner, Hudson, McNaughton, Marshall, the stadium was full, it was bouncing. I'm thinking to myself, if only the club could just recapture their moments. And I feel sorry for the fans, because the younger generation, they didn't see that. They're just seeing what's happening now, and it's sad in a way, but hopefully things can turn around.
That 2009-10 season is quite iconic, I suppose, in the memory of some Cardiff fans, because of the Chopra Boothroyd era. How good is that for you playing with Boothroyd?
Look, my ex-missus at the time, and Jay's missus, they got on so well. Even though we were getting divorced and that sort of thing, they always got on, and I would always have arguments with Jay off the pitch because of what was happening with my divorce, because Jay and his missus Stella were so close to Heather, my ex. And Jay used to come in training and say this and that, and I used to argue with him. But whenever we stepped on the pitch, it was like we just worked so well together. It was like I'd set Jay up, he'd set me up. We were good for each other, do you know what I mean? And people talk about partnerships, and people talk about Man United had Dwight York, Andy Cole, Blackburn had Shearer, Sutton, and Cardiff fans obviously, we had Chopra Boothroyd, and it was such a great partnership. It's just a shame that season we didn't get to the promised land, what we really believed that we should have done.
Who were the real jokers in that dressing room that season?
There was a lot.
Yourself?
Yeah, definitely myself. Yeah, myself, Jay Boothroyd, Kev McNaughton, Gavin Ray, Witts was a bit quiet, MacPhail was quiet, Joe Ledley was there.
Was he honing his dancing back then, Joe Ledley?
Yeah, he was doing the lawnmower dance whenever he scored. He was doing that. whenever he used to score, we would always shout to him, get the lawnmower out, and that sort of thing. But no, we had a group of lads that we would always play tricks and have good banter, and it wasn't, look, you could do something to one of the lads and they wouldn't get upset about it because they knew it was banter. And especially when there's like 5, 6, 7, 8 people involved, you know it's having a laugh. But then you've got to think about you're playing in a team and you're in a dressing room with 20 odd lads, and the only way this football club's going to do well is if everyone's in it together. And that's what I believe. Why have we done so well?
So given the camaraderie, the morale, everything like that, why then did you move to Ipswich?
Well, I had a meeting with Dave Jones, and he said to me that the owners didn't want me in the club anymore. And I think I had a year or two left. And I said to the gaffer, I said, Dave, what's your plans? Because we missed out on the playoffs as well. We got battered off Reading in the semi-finals. And Dave didn't even know his plans, what he was doing. He thought he might have got the sack as well. So I said, listen, there's no point in me being in a football club where the owners don't want me there after what I've done to the club, and for them to don't want me and that sort of thing. And however much trouble I was in the club, I was always producing on the pitch. Nobody could take that away. I was scoring goals and that sort of thing. I think that season I had a really bad injury on my ankle at the start of the season. I was out for like 3-4 months. But Craig Bellamy was there, and I think he was giving it to the owners that we need to get him out as well. He's a bad apple and that sort of thing. But I was the same player, the same person that I was 3-4 years ago when I first went to college.
Why do you think Craig Gallagher is doing that?
He probably, being at Man City, the professionalism at Man City, coming to Cardiff looking at me, didn't think I was professional enough. He wasn't happy at one game where Bristol City away, I think it was. For whatever reason, I was superstitious and I would always check my phone at half time, check a message, whatever. Sometimes I would get a message off a guy from Newcastle, Stephen Black, who was like a motivation person, and I was getting a message every now and again from him during games, reading the messages to myself to try and improve my game and think about this and that. And nobody knew about this. People would just think, oh, he's checking his phone just for football results or horse racing results. But when in fact it was I was getting a motivational speech from Stephen Black from Newcastle. And if people know the sports industry, he's worked with some top players. He worked with Johnny Wilkinson during his England days when England won the World Cup, the rugby. But people don't know that. And I think they probably thought that the professionalism of Michael Chopra isn't good enough. So we were playing Bristol City away. And I went to check my phone, and my phone wasn't there. And I said, Gaffer, someone pinched my phone. When in fact, Craig Bellamy told the fitness coach or one of the physios, get his phone out of his pocket, hide it somewhere so he's not checking up and it's not distracting him. So I just said to him, I said, listen, I want my phone, otherwise I'm not going out at half time. Do you know what I mean? I've done this every game. Why should I change? Whenever I've played Bristol City, I've always scored goals and that sort of thing as well. So I just said, I went, I want my phone, otherwise I'm not going out, because I knew I could have had a text message off Steve Black from about the motivation and trying to push me to work hard at my game a lot more. So I think since then he's probably thought in his head that I'm not professional enough for Cardiff City if they want to try and get in the Premier League and that sort of thing. And he's wrote about me in his book about the situation and that sort of thing. I'm not denying the situation because it happened, but there's reasons why it happened. So that's my reasons why. He probably thought I wasn't professional enough.
So you didn't want to leave the club, really, then, Cardiff?
No, I didn't want to really leave the club. We got to the playoffs 2 years in a row. But with Dave possibly moving, Mark Kennedy had went to Ipswich. I spoke to Sparky and I says, look, Cardiff want to get rid of me. Would Ipswich want me? Because I know Ipswich tried to sign me the summer before. Roy Keane was manager. I think they tried to sign me for like $4 million. Cardiff said no. So I said, listen, Cardiff are willing to let me go for $1 million. I said, speak to Paul Jewell, see if he wants me. And rang me back within 5 minutes and said, Chops, I want to sign you straight away. So then again, I was made feel wanted again by another manager, and Paul Jewell, who was brilliant with me as well. And I was just like, there's no point in being in one club where I'm not going to feel wanted, and I'm never going to play and could be stuck in the reserves and that sort of thing. And then whatever problems I've got, it's just going to be worse.
You went to Ipswich, you did really well that first season, but again, off-field problems. Again, you compartmentalised it because you had such a good season on the bench.
I scored 14 goals, I think it was. I think I was the first player for Ipswich in 5, 6, 7 years that had reached double figures as a striker. But whatever was happening off the pitch, like I said, fans were always, he's doing this off the pitch, he's going out, he's driving bans, he's involved with the police.
They wrote off a lot of your debt as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they wrote off. Well, they were good to me, Ipswich, really good. And I've got nothing against Ipswich Football Club. Marcus Evans, Simon Clegg at the time, Simon Milton, Paul Jewell, Mick McCarthy when he came in for the second season. They were all good with me, but some of the fans had this big thing about me that because of what's been going on in the background, I don't produce on the pitch. And I decided to take to Twitter and just to have a go at them, really. I was doing well, I was scoring goals and coming off the bench scoring goals. But fans pay their money, they have a right to say what they want, you know what I mean? I shouldn't have took to Twitter, I know I shouldn't, looking back, but every club I've been at, I always like the fans, do you know what I mean? The fans have paid their good money to come watch a team, they just want what's best for their team at the time, and I was at their team and they wanted me to do well, they expected probably more of me in the second season, but it didn't really happen.
Speaking of taking to Twitter, you also took to Twitter when you were at Blackpool talking about the training. You turned up and there were six players there and the fitness coach took training.
It was crazy because I spoke to one player, Stephen Davis, I think it was, and I texted him, I said, are you training tomorrow? And he went, no, I've got the day off. And I just said, what's going on here? How are these players getting the day off? And some players are going in. And so it wasn't a case of not playing and things, because I wasn't really playing much. But these other players weren't playing as well. So I just thought, fire it off, I'll go to training. If I don't turn up at training, you're going to get fined. So I just went, I'll go to training. So I got to training and I was like, what are we doing today? He's like, well, I went, how many people are here? And he was like, I counted, it was like six. So I just thought, sod this, I'm gonna write it on Twitter. Six people have turned up for training, it's a joke, fitness coach taking a football session. So we've done a football session with a fitness coach, and no disrespect, but fitness coaches don't know how to take a football session. It's just like a football guy wouldn't take a fitness session, wouldn't take a weight session, because it's not, they're not specialised in that department. So, and then we went for a walk like along the promenade and that sort of thing, and I'm just thinking to myself, why have I even drove down from Newcastle to come and do this? Driven 3 hours, 3.5 hours to turn up and do this. I couldn't, what's the point? And I took to Twitter, and the club were owners who they were, the Oystons, they were running the club how they wanted and desperate to take money from players, that just decided to fire me and that sort of thing, and spoke to the PFA about I tried to say somebody else hacked my account and wrote it on Twitter and that sort of thing, and they were laughing at me and they were like, nah, we can't, it's not, that's all serious and stuff like that, because I went, nah, I told one of my mates someone's hacked my account and that sort of thing, they weren't having it. I think I've got fined like 10 grand, but it's life, isn't it? You've got to get on with it. I can laugh and joke it about now, but in a way I shouldn't have done it, do you know what I mean? You've got to respect the club and they pay your wages, so you've got to respect them.
So after Blackpool, you went out to Kerala Blasters, massive change of scenery for you. What was it like out there playing football?
Well, I knew India were going to do a new league, the Indian Super League. It was just a case of when it was going to happen. I had offers to stay in the UK and play in the UK, but I was pretty much finished. I'd achieved what I needed to achieve in the UK. Played in the Premier League, played Champions League, scored goals, team of the seasons. So I just decided to go venture out and do something different. Obviously, being half Indian, it would have made my dad proud as well, playing in India. His family would have been proud, and there was a draft and a new league set up, and then all these big name players were playing it. I know they passed it: Del Piero, Trezeguet, Anelka, Matarazzi, Nesta, Captavilla. David James was the manager of Kerala Blasters. But you had all these big superstars that were going to India to play in this new league. So I just said, why not go out there and venture and play there for 3 months? So I decided to do it. And do you know what? From the day I went out there, it made me appreciate life a lot more, because you don't get any middle class. You're either rich or you're poor. You're living in a 7-star hotel. As soon as you step out, you're seeing underprivileged people, kids, walking the streets begging for money. And it made me appreciate life a lot more. It made me change the person and to look at life and to look at other people a lot more. And the ego, what I used to have, is it suddenly disappeared.
Because you tried to play for the Indian national team,
yeah,
didn't you? When you were out there. But that never materialised.
For me to play for the national team, I would have had to give up my English passport, get an Indian one. And then it was like, I'd have to get visas to come back to the UK, and you don't know if you're going to get them. They're the only country in the world that don't do dual citizenship. And then I was just thinking, it's going to be too much hassle to try and fulfil probably your family's dream to play for Indian national team. And I spoke to Sachin Tendulkar, they tried to push it, but...
What did Sachin say to
you? They were all for it, they were trying to push it, because he was the owner of the football club, Kerala Blasters.
Really?
He was the owner of the club, yeah, he was the big superstar. Each team has a big superstar owner, and he was the owner of Kerala Blasters. So I spoke to him about it. He was getting the lawyers involved and that sort of thing, but eventually we were just, for however long it was going to take, it was just for the time. By the time I got it, it would take 2-3 years, it would have been pointless.
So you're now officially retired from football then, even though you never announced it, I guess. What are you up to now? You're living in Amsterdam, aren't you?
Yeah, so I was doing the TV in India, and I got asked to be on a panel, a conference, and Ajax Youth Academy, head of Ajax Youth, was there, put on the screen everything about Ajax. They were trying to make Indian football better, having all these people from around the world come and discuss about what they should do in infrastructure in India. So I just got chatting to the guy from Ajax about why is Ajax so good about producing players, and that's so he gave me the insight, and this is the program we do and that sort of thing. And he was like, I'm going to put you in touch with my good friend, he's an agent. So I got talking to his good friend George, Greek guy George Kazianis, and we just got discussing. Obviously my new missus was Dutch, so I was going from India, I was eventually going to go back to Amsterdam and live in Amsterdam, but we just got discussing. He was like, what are you up to? I was like, well, I'm doing the TV, the Champions League and everything in India, but I want to do something different, I want to stay involved in football, but I don't want to coach and that sort of thing. So we just decided to, he said to me, why don't you not try and be an agent? You've got your contacts in the UK, that sort of thing. So I just said, yeah, I'm not going to go and get my license, be a UK licensed agent. I'll put players, bring players to you and you can try and get them into clubs. So we've done that, and it's been good, it's been exciting, and you're seeing what really goes on behind the scenes when you try to move a player. We moved Jason Punchin from Crystal Palace to a team in Cyprus called Pavos. So I was working with Jason's agency in England, which is Wasserman WMG, who used to look after me when I was a player. And I just connected everyone together, and they sorted the deal out in Cyprus. That's exciting. I'm really enjoying it. You see, you're involved in football, you get to know what's going on in different clubs and that sort of thing. So you're still involved, but on a different point of view.
How have you taken to life in Amsterdam?
I love it. Yeah, I love Amsterdam. Love it. Such a beautiful city. It's different to the UK because people know who you are in the UK. You've always got to... You've got to... It's not an ego thing, but you've got to be careful about what you're doing on a night out. That's, whereas in Holland, it's like, just go and do what I want. People respect you as long as you respect them. And it's such a great city, and I love living in it.
Do you see you doing this for the long term?
I think so, yeah. I'll probably continue to do it, yeah. It's what I'm enjoying doing. I get to go watch football matches. Doing something that would never have thought of. You're looking at contracts, I've got knowledge of it, so and then you've just got to use your connections, which I've got in England in any case, trying to find players' clubs.
Michael Chopra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So thank you for listening to that Michael Chopra special. I hope you all enjoyed it, and as ever, make sure you keep up to date with all the Cardiff City news at Wales Online.